The Guardian. Hello, I'm Rosie Swash, and welcome to Music Weekly. In today's podcast, we explore the sound of LA-based experimentalists Warpaint, Alexis Petridis, currently snowed in Brighton, I might add, hooked up with Warp's new Brooklyn signings, The Hundreds in Their Hands, and in Singles Club, we run the rule over tracks by Adele, Anna Calvi, and the Manic Street Preachers. That's all coming up in today's Music Weekly. Hello to you, Tim Jones.
Hello, Rosie.
How are you? I don't know. Yeah. Like we don't sit next to each other.
Like you haven't heard me whining about having a cold. I'm back now, back on top form.
Yes.
Going to absolutely monster this podcast.
Excellent, good news. And hello to the Guardian Guide's Will Dean.
Hello there, Rosie.
How is your health?
My health is good. My big news is I'm in the process of adopting a cat called, brilliantly, Yoko.
Oh.
So that's...
So wait a second. Is this one of those things like where you adopt a goat but you don't actually have
the goat?
No,
it's a full-on, we would be the family, you know, you can call us your real mum and dad now, that kind of
Oh, that's adopting. So nice. And we should probably point out that we're probably going to have a Yoko Ono special feature with no name next week.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
If you wanted to find out what your cat thinks of that and let us know, that'd be great.
Yeah, I'll play it.
So let's get straight on to Warpaint. They are four girls from LA that gets some critics thinking about Mazzie Star and the Cowboy Junkies. They've been compared to Slits, the XX also, genres like slowcore, I mentioned. Now, amid all these comparisons, the band have appeared on the cover of Enemy, and they played sold-out shows all across the UK, so you could definitely say that they are having their moment right now. But this isn't simply about being a buzz band, as Warpaint have been going since 2004. So I wanted Emily Kokel and Teresa Wayman from the band to explain why Warpaint have had such a slow gestation.
I think that patience has been actually a really great ally in our band to find our sound and to not feel any pressure. And then also, you know, I think the band and the relationships within the band have created why we've developed the way that we've developed, just the way that we relate to each other musically. Everybody had this similar just like ease about just finding out who the band was at first and foremost, you know.
It's not like we were sitting in our garage playing music and never dreaming of the day that someone would hear it and like it. And I mean, that's like every young girl's dream, if you're a musician or whatever. Like, that was our young girl dream. There's these cute young girls that have just started a band that live in like Austin or right outside of there.
Good place to live if you're going to start a band.
Eye of the Day.
Oh yeah, Eye of the Day. And they always come to our shows in Texas, and they're just like, so they say that they're really inspired by us, and that's really awesome.
They're good.
Yeah.
Eye of the Day.
Presumably, the first shows you played were in LA, and that's when you played quite a lot of shows, is that?
Yeah, we averaged about, I think it was like a show a week almost, because we did like, for 1 year after the release of our EP, or actually right when we finished recording it, which was the beginning, 2008. So that year we did like four residencies and a whole bunch of different shows, and we're just like always playing out. Up until that point, we had barely played any shows. And then we finally left. Mm-hmm. And that's when we met up with the A&R guy from Rough Trade.
Told by, particularly by English bands who've played LA, that they've got the best hecklers at gigs in LA, like you get the best response. There's one band that said when they're on stage, someone shouted out, "Oh my god, I'm so fucking pissed, you guys, you're so awesome." is that true? You know, is it true? Do you have the best heckles?
I could imagine Los Angeles crowds going crazy for a good band they see that's from overseas or something. People in Echo Park getting really excited about it.
People are pretty nice in Los Angeles.
Yeah, and in our neighborhood, in the artist area, they're like weirdos.
Why are you laughing? Is that it's not its official name?
Because she did the quote unquote.
Oh, it's like the Brooklyn and Williamsburg of LA. It's Echo Park. It's a little bit east of Silver Lake, which is now was that and is still that, but it's more like artists who make a lot of money there.
Okay.
And then it's like spreading out to Eagle Rock, this other place, and Pasadena. But those were all like, yeah, these are all Latin neighborhoods. And now we're like moving in with raw food restaurants and like juice bars and coffee shops and stuff.
Read somewhere that you guys, because you're not all from LA, that you were deciding whether it was between LA and New York that you wanted to live and work in, and why did you pick LA over New York?
It was interesting to be in LA. You can make things happen there like you can in New York or something, you know, like there's just a lot of interesting people. It's semi-international. I think New York's a bit more international, but it's still an international city, you know?
There's something relaxing about California and, you know, you have the warmth and you can go into nature really easily, and it's really grown on me in a lot of ways.
It's easier to survive there than in New York. And there's a lot more, like, I think, couch surfing and getting by with little, because
not have a job there.
Yeah, because the apartments tend to be bigger than just like this room.
So you were living together in one apartment, not in that, and it's affordable to do that in LA.
Yeah.
Actually, Dave Sitek said that, so that's why he moved to LA, isn't he? Because the rent in New York just got way too high.
Yeah. For a closet or something. Yeah. Without a bathroom.
That was Emily Kokel and Teresa Wayman from Warpaint talking to me. Really nice girls. Really interesting and fun, a little bit reticent during the interview process. And I find that with certain kinds of American bands like Animal Collective, there's almost as if they want to pretend they don't know what you're trying to get at, or they just don't want to play along. Can I be so bold as to ask if that has ever happened to you, Tim Jones?
It happens a lot. I think maybe a bit of it is being on the cover of loads of magazines, being suddenly hyped as the greatest band on earth when they probably weren't expecting it necessarily. Comes a bit of a shock, and probably suddenly they're meeting all these new people.
You're such an empathetic person. You're always good at seeing the motivations behind why someone might be the way they are.
I am I'm a great person.
You're a great man.
I'm just a great person.
Tell me your thoughts on the album.
I like it. I mean, I knew about the band quite a long time ago, actually, and there's kind of been quite a slow build of people saying, oh, Warpaint are great, you should check them out. Mm. And I was really excited by them. I mean, when the album came out, I first heard it, I thought, oh, is this what all the fuss is about? But it is one of those kind of very subtle, and I think people compare them to the XX. They don't really sound like the XX that much, do they?
But minimalism.
Yeah, and with the same way, the XX album kind of just creeped up on me. I didn't really think it was going to be one of my albums of the year, and in the end it was. I think it's good. It hasn't blown me away.
No.
But what do you think?
I wasn't that aware of them before, I must say, and it did suddenly seem like everybody was talking about this band, which is weird because they've been around for about 6 years, and it is also weird to put your debut album out after being together for 6 years. I think what I like about it is there's a lot of, and I'm going to use one of those wanky music critic terms, undulation in it throughout the album, and the songs is just a real sense of almost psychedelic movement to what they're doing. You always kind of want to back away from calling any band that features predominantly female members. You don't want to talk about technique too much because they always seem to get slagged off not being able to play their instruments. But there's almost a kind of willful shabbiness to what they do. You know, when they did the live session for us, they weren't too fussed about bum notes and stuff like that. I really like it. Will, are you a fan?
I would echo a lot of what Tim said in that I've listened to it a couple of times, found it really pleasant and nice, and sort of think what they're doing is interesting, but I've not gone back to it as much as many other records. I mean, just to go back to something you said about it being slightly strange that they've, you know, waited 6 years to put a record out, I think that there's actually a lot to be said for that. I think the Roses were together for 10 years, weren't they? And then that's kind
actually,
of why their first record was so amazing. I mean,
and the second record came out like that.
Yeah, well, but I mean, just in terms of doing your sort of your Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours, learning your trade, learning how each other works. I mean, obviously, very different to the Stone Roses first record, but just as a way of kind of forming your band's identity and stuff, I think taking your time rather than just banging it out as soon as you get signed is a good way to go.
The sound itself is quite complex on a lot of tracks. I know you said, because when we watched them play, there was a slight shabbiness to the playing, which was endearing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's not
because they can't play.
Yeah, it's not three chord punk, is it? You know,
exactly.
there really is a very kind of intricate kind of weaving of sound, especially on the track they did for us, Warpaint, which is a really kind of clever song, the way it builds. And that's
what I mean by the undulation, is wherever they start seems to be quite different from where they end
definitely.
Up, but it totally works.
I mean, it's quite weird, unique music. I was watching that Rough Trade documentary the other day, you know, the history of Rough Trade that the BBC did, and I was watching the Raincoats were in session, and it kind of depressed me because I thought, God, that looks so cool. We're kind of 30 years on now, and it's still kind of unusual to have an all-girl group.
Yeah.
I've seen that with the NME cover. When was the last time you saw? I don't think there has been.
It's just bizarre, isn't it? That's still, in 2010, is still quite an interesting point about a band, is that they're all female.
I know, and it is a shame. And I feel, personally, sound-wise, I'm always still a bit surprised by the Slits comparisons, because I don't think they sound anything like the Slits. Do you hear that, either of you? So that must be, they look a bit cool and they're female.
I think
like
a bit of it is because they're called Warpaint, and the Slits on their debut album had kind of camouflage on.
Okay, well, I like it. It's getting some mixed reactions here, but that is The Fool by Warpaint. It's a debut album and it's out now. Time for Singles Club now. As usual, we've all selected a track to discuss, and we're going to start off with Tim's choice. That was Love Won't Be Leaving by Anna Calvi. Tim, tell us why that is your choice, please.
My favourite album of this year is Zola Jesus. And even though Anna Calvi doesn't sound like Zola Jesus, I think they've got similarities in that they've taken a kind of quite gothic sound and made it quite cool, made it quite hipster. But I mean, I just love the drama in all of her music. It's really dramatic, it's really filmic, really epic. There's a lot of kind of focus on dynamics,
Cymbals
being struck and like big twangs of guitar. And she's really influenced by, I think, she has classical music and opera and flamenco.
But also cinematic stuff, right?
Yeah, like Ennio Morricone. I hear a bit of kind of surf guitar, Dick Dale kind of. Mm. And also she's really fond of she's really like big into being a guitarist in a kind of inspiring way. She's just really into being a kind of guitar hero in a way that you don't really get upon.
Almost no hype about her whatsoever, which is quite refreshing. Is there? I don't know.
Can we start the hype machine here?
Yeah, this is it.
She is the next hype starts. Big thing.
Poor woman. You know, tipped for Sounds of 2011 on the BBC poll next.
Going back to the kind of depressing thing I was talking about before, apparently she's the third female solo artist ever to be signed to Domino in their 17-year history.
Well, this is it. We were talking about something to do with this the other day, and we said, oh, well, you know, what women are on Domino? And we couldn't think. It is such a blow. It doesn't strike me as particularly blokey.
I don't think it's very laddie.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's more just it's that kind of indie. Yeah.
James Yorkston.
Who are the other two women?
Juana Molina. And we don't know who the third one is. Producer Ian tells me one of them is Juana Molina. And we don't know who the other one is. I can't think.
Help us out.
Will, are you a fan? Have you been caught up in the hype bubble that we just started?
I mean, I liked it before, though. You know, people were banging on about.
Yeah, I liked it when she used it.
There's a couple of things that Tim mentioned that I kind of had written similar things to my notes, the theatricality of it and the drama. And I'd written down, sort of sounds like a scene in a Western movie, you know, where John Wayne kind of strolls out of a saloon in a very good way. I find that quite exciting. And then the sort of surfy, slidey guitar dropping in, which reminded me of Wicked Game.
I thought of that one.
A bit like Warpaint, actually, the way that it built up and combined loads of elements, and her voice is kind of going one way, sort of a slightly Nico-y vibe there. And then the build to that big sort of dramatic finish at the end where there is this kind of big floor toms being smashed and cymbals, and it all kind of combines to a sort of theatrical, as we said, sort of denouement. It's really good. I liked it.
I do like her. I think she's got a great deal of presence. And, you know, I think it's okay for me to say this because I am a woman. She is a very sexy woman. She looks fantastic.
She looks incredible. She looks a bit like Nick Cave on the from Her to Eternity album cover. But it's quite a kind of slightly androgynous look, though, isn't it?
I was thinking more of the Girls from the Robert Palmer video, that kind of slicked back 80s hair, very strong makeup. I like this kind of spectral elements of her music. There's something a bit menacing and removed about the way she performs that makes me think of Cat Power. Like, actually, even if you were in a tiny venue, she was on stage, you'd feel like she'd be just staring into the middle distance. Apparently, she's great live. Debut album is, we think, self-titled, Anna Calvi, and it's out in January. Okay, next up on Singles Club, it's my turn. Never mind, I'll find someone. That was Someone Like You by Adele. I'm gonna shoot myself in the hipster foot with this one because I saw Adele performing on Later with Jules Holland. You know, yeah, not very credible, sorry guys. But I just was completely blown away. And I think the thing about her is she was 18, 19 when she was signed. I remember seeing her a few times around London. Obviously got this incredible voice. Then with the album, it was like, I can see what you're doing here. You're going for middle of the road, American market. Cool, why not? Big voices sell. And so I just completely dismissed it. You know, it wasn't for me, and I didn't enjoy the album that much, which was called 19. So when I heard that she was back, I wasn't that interested in it. They put out a promo for Rolling in the Deep, which is produced by Paul Epworth and has a real Florence and the Machine feel to it, which it is a really good pop song. But then I saw this on Jules Holland and it actually did bring tears to my eyes because it's the premise of the song is she meets up with an old lover and he's moved on, he's married now. And just that, you know, that line in the chorus, never mind, I'll find someone like you. It's just like, oh, you know, it's trying to be casual about something. You can imagine her just walking off and crying after this meeting. And it also just reminds me that she has actually got this incredible voice and it was a really, really good performance, like really good. So she's, you know, someone who has become big in America, you know, had to up her game and has done so successfully. So based on that, I am actually looking forward to her new album. I found this like unbelievably heartbreaking, brilliant song, Will.
There's a lot to be said for a really good breakup song, isn't there? I mean, that they stay with you in a way that, you know, a good song you can dance to might invoke great memories, but you know, the feeling of listening to a song when you're 17 or whatever that reminds you of someone and then hearing it 10 years later. And obviously that is literally what the song is about. But whereas with 19 and Chasing Pavements, those songs, like, yeah, I wasn't that moved, there's a real sadness in her voice there that I don't think was there. There was a little bit in the middle where she talks about turning up to the house uninvited, which doesn't sound anything like it, but just sort of reminded me of a kind of Elvis Costello kind of couplet. And I suspect if I was in a sad place, that would be a really nice thing to listen to. And actually, you know, it's quite a positive message. She's not kind of chasing after him. She's saying, well, you know, we had a good time and I'm upset, but, you know, there's plenty more fish in the sea and all that.
That's a very positive reading of that song. She's kind of chasing after him, isn't she? Just
through
other people.
No, it's cool. It's cool that you've moved on. I'll just find someone exactly like you.
But it's kind of the moment of realisation, isn't it? Where she's going, it isn't to be, I still thought it was, and that's really upsetting and sad, and that's why it's a sad song. But
yeah, it's incredibly bittersweet. Tim, did it move you to tears?
Yes, it did in a way. I think what's weird about Adele is her first album was 19 and the next album was called 21.
Yeah.
But you would never...
I would hazard a guess that is to do with her age.
I suppose the obvious kind of gag would be to say, you know, you'd imagine it should really be called, you know, 39 and 41, because these are such adult themes that she's writing about, and it's kind of weird that a 21-year-old can speak about love as if she's lived it all.
I don't think it is, though. I mean, I think when you're 19 and you're 21, these things sort of dominate poignant. Your lives yeah, in a way that they don't.
Yeah, I think that's true,
you...
but then quite often you don't hear people singing about it in this way. I guess it's more a kind of joyriding, sniffing glue, going out and, you know, do you know what I mean? It's quite rare to hear.
On the side of Nelson's column, because yeah,
exactly.
That's what the kids do.
I suppose it's quite rare to hear someone speaking about it in quite a mature way. Mm. And I suppose it sets with people like Rumour as the kind of the more adult side of female soul singers around at the moment. But I do think just by having very simplistic lyrics that go straight for your heart, that it's always good, even though musically it doesn't, you know, thrill me.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, it's impossible to hear some of those lines and not kind of get a kind of shudder through you. So for that, I give it credit.
That was Someone Like You by Adele. It's going to be on 21, her second album, and that is going to be out at some point in January. And lastly, let's turn to Will's choice. That was Manic Street Preachers featuring Ian McCulloch with Some Kind of Nothingness, which I originally read as Some Kind of Naughtiness. So, Will, why have you brought that in?
What kind of naughtiness?
Yeah.
Well, this is the second single from the Manics' latest album, which, I mean, the song is obviously very upbeat. Ian, the producer, just whispered to you that it's very Radio 2, which is pretty much spot on. I think they obviously made a decision to make a big pop record after, you know, the sort of Jackie Collins existential question time of the Richie album that they did last. Possibly, you know, in the same way they cut Everything Must Go was a slightly sort of cheery-ish pop record. Mm. I don't love it. I think it's quite interesting. I think Ian McCulloch's really good on it. It sounded very Britpop to me, which I don't think we're necessarily ready for that revival yet, are we? But I liked it. The other thing I wanted to mention was that they're performing it on tomorrow's Strictly Come Dancing. They're performing it with Ian. And in an interview a few weeks ago, Nikki promised that it would be a situationist spectacle, you know, on Saturday night primetime telly. So
Paul Brutti, get prepared.
I mean, it's quite a leap, isn't it, from the sort of Mascara and Richie years to...
Well, this is it, because us being of similar, not so advanced years, were you a fan of theirs around the period of your adolescence? Because
yeah, well,
I wasn't, because they'd already got to the point where the Holy Bible and that kind of thing were quite far back for them.
I was a sort of young teenager when Everything Must Go came out and sort of got into them at the period when, you know, the Radio 2 listening public did. So I've kind of known the Manics from them always being a pop group. Mm. So this to me doesn't feel like a huge leap into the unknown. But obviously I'm kind of aware of the Holy Bible and the other two records before Everything Must Go. I mean, it's kind of nice pop guitar music that you would quite happily have on in a garage as you were getting your car fixed. But I can't see myself in 5 years thinking, I remember when I broke up to that Manics album.
The thing about the Manics is, like I said, they were already elder statesmen of a certain kind of rock and pop by the time I reached the point where you start to look into all different kinds of music. And I know Alexis loves to portray my teenage years as being down twice as nice with a bottle of Moët, dancing around my handbag to Wookiee or something like that. But I did actually used to spend a great deal of my time in some of London's insalubrious indie clubs. And there was always two Manic songs that got... Well, they did used to play Everything Must Go, but they would always play You Love Us and Motorcycle Emptiness. And those are the only two Manic songs I've ever liked. And they remain two, because I don't really like this one. Sorry. Tim?
Well, I'll always love the Manic Street Preachers for what they are and just how funny Nicky Wire is, basically.
I mean, I just think you need big mouthpieces like that.
And just, you know, the history of that band is just so fantastic. Yeah, the records that I like, you know, I don't like a lot of their records, but I do really like some of them. This, to me, is kind of the worst side of them. It's almost like everything they do badly combined into a into a record.
With Ian McCulloch?
Yeah, it's just like it was watching them kind of trundle around town in the video with their jeans and trainers on.
That's horrible, isn't it?
And then I just, the tempo of this song is just such a plod, and it just really reminds me of the worst bits of 90s Britpop, and it's just so
when no one's really got anything
dreary
to say.
And it doesn't have any life to it. And the thought of them playing on, it better be a situationist spectacle, otherwise it really will be the kind of nadir of there. So I hope something crazy happens.
All right, well, you know, take to the blog and let us know what you think about the situationist gig, if it happens, on Strictly. That was Manic Street Preachers, Some Kind of Nothingness. It's on Postcards from a Young Man, which is out now. Let's have a bit of feedback from last week's show, which we brought forward a few days to coincide with the release of Nicki Minaj's album Pink Friday, which we reviewed when it was kind of a thumbs down. And nobody on the blog seemed to like her either. E.I. Spangles said, Nicki Minaj sampling Annie Lennox, what the fuck? Big Bad Albert said, thank God for autotune. Imagine what this Harridan would sound like without it, which is just...
Harridan's a good word, isn't it?
I was about to say, that's really mean, but Will likes it.
No, not as a, just as a word.
Yeah. Ice Murph said, don't want to sound pervy, but what are you lot doing while the clip from Singles Club is playing? I can't help but imagine you all momentarily lose yourself, big box, little box style, then suddenly return to reality as the clip ends. P.S. If this clip is added in post-production, I'd rather not know. So, well, we couldn't really do, it wasn't really a kind of Singles Club for any boxing, was it? A bit of tears.
Boxing.
Yeah, little box, you know. It wasn't a ravey Singles Club this week.
Well,
but
we have curtains open in the room, so if we do a dance, as I did earlier, you know, everyone can see from the T-points. So.
Mate, that wasn't a dance.
What was it? A thrust.
It was a singular thrust.
A sexy thrust.
I don't know about that. So that is your feedback from last week's show. It's a general thumbs down for Nicki Minaj. Thanks for your comments. Remember, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly is the place to leave them. Now, before he got snowed in, Alexis was out with his recording gear and he spoke to the hundreds in the hands. Eleanor Everdell and Jason Friedman bonded whilst listening to Marauder/Molten-style disco, French house and minimal techno. Alexis asked them how they went from fake folk music to that.
Oh, you think so? And when the lights all go out, slay me, hold me down, and hollow out my heart.
Last time I met you, you were sort of purveying a kind of faux kind of folk music in the bogs, kind of ramshackle thing, and we had a conversation about how the acoustics in New York subways were good for busking and stuff like that. Obviously, the bogs are a band that changed a lot. I mean, you made three albums that were almost completely different from each other. But how did you get from there to what you're doing now?
I mean, there was just lots of different things that I was interested in, which is why the records changed so much. So I think my head was just pointing in that direction, and I had met Eleanor for the last Boggs tour. At that point, the band was just me and whoever I was playing with. So we met, and then a month later, we were on tour together for a month and a half or so, and that's how we got to know each other. And there was just instantly, as we were listening to music in the van and stuff, there was a real connection, and it just seemed like a good direction to go in.
Your influences seem incredibly esoteric. Some of them you can understand by listening to the music. I get the dub thing because of the spaciness of the music. I get the kind of post-punk aspect of it. You talk also a lot about your love of early hip-hop. What is it that you love about that, and how does that kind of impact on the sound of the Hundred in the Hands?
It's one of those things that, I don't know why, we were just getting really excited about it, just talking about the old sound systems. I just love when you see clips like in Wild Style and those old movies where it really just is such a, I can't even imagine a genre coming in, you know, in that the way that hip-hop must have appeared out of nowhere. It's like dark rooms with red lights and just one guy and a microphone and one simple reductive beat going on and on forever. It's something really interesting about that.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is the sonics and the textures. Like, I think there's an aspect of it that's like, we really like kind of heavy low-end, like, really boomy, you know, kicks that kind of resonate in your chest, and then built on top of that, like, my voice is like high and girly and floaty, and then there's harmonies and stuff like that. I feel like that's stuff that is done well in R&B and hip-hop. So maybe there's some of that, but more than that, I think the whole ethos of early hip-hop and it being the next extension of ska, dub, that came from Jamaica and then followed through in the US in New York, which is where we live. I think all of those elements come together, and there's a certain something that we love about it.
you've worked with some really interesting people and some really different people. I mean, you've worked with Chateauneuf, Richard X, right, I'm thinking. How do those kind of collaborations come about? How do you choose what people you're going to work with and what appeals to you about, say, Richard? I mean, Richard X, who's known in Britain mostly as a pop producer, you know, he's an out-and-out kind of pop producer. What appealed to you about him and what did you think he could bring to your sound?
Because we were writing kind of in pop form, we wanted to go with someone who knew the tricks of how to do it. But Richard was a really good choice because he makes big pop songs, but his own taste is kind of more left of the dial, you know.
His record collection is massive and it's full of like weirdo dance tracks and, you know, like 7 inches that there are only 100 copies of or whatever.
So it was a good place to go with someone like that and meet somewhere else different and kind of push each other out of comfort zones and go make something that we wouldn't have done on our own. But the way we worked with him was the songs were more or less finished. It was just about, you know, kind of cleaning them up and throwing in some of those tricks.
It's a conscious decision to go to dance producers, though. I mean, these people like Chateauneuf and Richard X are best known as kind of for beaty stuff.
Yeah, I think the whole kind of dance thing came from a few different places. When we were on that tour, actually, we opened for Hot Ship at a couple shows, and we're just totally excited by how ramped up the crowd was, how they were having this whole experience with each other, not even like paying attention to the band sometimes, just like, you know, super elated and having fun. That combined with other dance stuff that we were listening to at the time kind of got us going, and then working with Jacques and getting that whole kind of like mellow, disco-y, DFA-ish sound in our blood, and some of those textures all kind of fed into producing things in a more polished pop dance kind of way.
One thing I love that you do is that your website is more like a fanzine than a website. You seem to spend a lot of time on it, like enthusing about other artists, together kind of playlists and things like that, which is great. I really, really like that, rather than doing, here's our new record, you know what I mean? Go out and buy a new record kind of thing. What sort of inspired you to do that?
Exactly that. Like, we just didn't want to have to only talk about ourselves. And we have lots of friends and people who are doing interesting things, and it was just an excuse to kind of
talk about them. Like, the combination of being in a band and having a website allows you to seek out people that you're interested in and be like, what you're doing is really rad, will you talk to me about it? And they will.
Like, the guy who just did our latest single cover is someone that we just liked his website, and so we emailed him and did an interview with him, and through that he ended up doing the artwork for us.
One song that really intrigues me now is Last City, which seems to have a kind of real end of days lyrical feel to it. Is that, am I right? Am I totally barking up the wrong tree there? Is it about the coming apocalypse?
Yeah, and well, it's kind of a sci-fi song in a way, but it's also just kind of like an apocalypse of the everyday. There's kind of that double exposure of, on one hand, it is just about the apocalypse, and the other hand, it is that the oppressive feeling of being in a city where, like, sometimes it just feels pretty dark. There's some nerdy references in that song to films like La Jetée and Hiroshima Mon Amour and that kind of stuff.
Ever since Britpop in Britain, there's been too much pretending you're thicker than you actually are. You know, you're more stupid than you actually are. I like a band that drops a few Nouveau Vague references in their music and in their interviews. That's marvellous.
I have no idea what he's talking about.
just mainly interested in beer and football, like.
Was Hunters in the Hands chatting to Alexis in Brighton, I believe, is where he recorded that interview. They kind of been bubbling under in 2010. I wouldn't necessarily say they've had a lot of attention. I think we had them on Singles Club months ago. I think Michael Hamm brought it in. So my knowledge of them didn't go beyond their single Pigeons, which I actually really liked. They kind of made me think about some of the, like, if they'd been out in 2005... I know it sounds like a really horrible thing to say about a band, but I don't mean it in that way. I just mean, you know, when Modular were putting out all these compilations like Leave Them All Behind and be Errol Alcan remixing Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. So that's what it makes me think of. And so I do like it. I just think perhaps it just doesn't feel that in keeping with what's happening in the rest of music, particularly stuff that's coming out of Brooklyn. I mean, I read a Pitchfork review that started off, competent is the word that comes to mind when discussing singer Eleanor Everdell and Jason Friedman's debut full-length album as The Hundred in Hands. Now, that is quite cruel. I think that is a cruel way to start a review, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I think it's good, but it's just slightly out of time, so it's going to slip under some people's radars. The Hundreds in the Hands self-titled album is out now, and that brings us to the end of this week's Music Weekly. Thank you very much to Tim Jones for coming in.
No problem. It was great.
And to you, Guardian Guides Will Dean. Always says Guardian Guides Will Dean.
Give me my full name. No, thank you for having me.
My thanks to producer Ian. I'm Rosie Swash. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.